Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to the Hour of the Time with your host here, Doyle Shamley, in Eager, Arizona, this wonderful June evening, 2008. Now, I want to thank all of you for tuning in, and first, our contact information. If you'd like to contact the Hour of the Time, you may do so by writing Hour of the Time, or HOTT, H-O-T-T, P.O. Box 940, Eager, spelled E-A-G-A-R, Arizona, 85925. Again, that's Hour of the Time, P.O. Box 940, Eager, Arizona, 85925. The website, hourofthetime.com, that's hourofthetime.com. The studio number, 928-333-2942. And my personal email address, hourofthetime@hotmail.com. That's hourofthetime@hotmail.com. Now this evening I have some updates for you, and then we'll get into our programming. Tonight's episode is Greenhouse Gases Up in Smoke, or Global Warming Up in Smoke. But first I want to remind everybody about our conference. We're wrapping up the sign-ups, etc., to get registered to come. And our registration is not some major data collecting scheme. Don't worry about that. There's been quite a bit of paranoia about a person's safety while here, and that's absolutely ludicrous. You are more than safe and secure at our conferences. But our conference in October, 6th through 10th, private location just for us. Meals served on-site, cooked fresh every meal. We are waiving the breakfast for a mid-morning snack. We found in the past that most people didn't eat the breakfast, but a mid-morning snack of muffins and fruits and vegetables and drinks went over a lot better. But a regular full-course lunch and dinner, fresh every meal, every day. All your notebooks that you take home at the end of the week, but you get them on the first day. I don't mean blank notebooks. I mean working materials already made with dividers. That way you can take notes in the margins, highlight, etc., as you go through the week for the different classes. Expendable materials that you'll use with hand-on exercises, herbs that you'll take home yourself from tinctures that you make, etc., and poultices and salves and lozenges. All that, plus some CD information and DVD information, all-inclusive, and your lodging for $650 for the entire week. You won't find that anywhere else at any price. Our repertoire, our classes, our hands-on training, classroom, outdoors, mixed every day. You won't get that anywhere else. And even if someone else did offer it, they would be jamming you for the price, I guarantee you. So make sure to hurry up and get registered. Contact me, hourofthetime@hotmail.com, if you're interested. We also, on our website, hourofthetime.com, have a conference page. And that'll take you to the shopping cart if you choose to go that route for payment. And also there is a full schedule day by day. Now we are juggling slightly. I'm not talking about canceling, just moving some of the classes around so they'll better fit a mixture of indoor and outdoor activities per day and our guests' schedules. Okay? Because some of our guests have found that, well, Thursday would be better for me to come than Wednesday because of travel arrangements. The earlier you do this and make your arrangements, the less expensive your traveling will be. Some people opt to drive, some people fly, use the train, what have you. So I would suggest getting those arrangements, and if you have some commitment to an employer, whatnot, that way you can make those arrangements early as well. Now, if you have little children you need to bring along that aren't going to participate in the classroom activities, etc., but you don't want to leave them with a relative or babysitter or what have you for a week plus, feel free to bring them. Just make sure they're not running around breaking things and pulling apart people's laptop computers and upsetting the classes a lot, okay? That's all I ask. We're very patient, of course, and realize you might have to come and go out of the classroom to check on the little ones. But we just ask that you don't make it a huge nuisance on everybody. Bringing children will not be a nuisance, though. Don't get me wrong. Just don't bring eight of them screaming and crying all day in the classroom. Take them back to your lodging if you need to settle them down or they need a nap or something, okay? That's all we ask. And there are tons of extracurricular activities around the site. So don't be worried about bringing other family members if you wish to. And if you need someone has to come with you and they want to eat, but they're not going to attend any classes, we'll make special arrangements. That's why you contact me directly for anything that isn't just verbatim. You're attending, notebooks, meals, etc. type schedule. Just contact me, and we do barter as well. Someone paid us in gold and silver, for instance, and that was perfectly acceptable. Now, again, my thanks out to Rob and Terry and John and everybody and Colleen and Eva out there that helped the Hour of the Time. Monty, of course, as well. And sometimes I know I forget Monty, just not even thinking about it, because I don't talk to him that often because everything runs so smooth. But he's right in there as well and instrumental. And don't forget those of you also out there, if you want to write a little thank you or something, note to these people that carry our broadcast or help out in the operations, please do so. It's not just Doyle and or just Doyle and Rob, although a lot of it is. We do have people that help us day in and day out behind the scenes. Now, that's about it for the announcements for this evening. So we'll go to a musical break for a couple minutes, play a couple interlude songs here as a short break. Let me get a glass of water. A lot of speaking tonight, and we're going to get into the global warming up in smoke episode tonight, this beautiful evening, June 2008. right, ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to your host here, Doyle Shamley, with the Hour of the Time. And a few quick notes more on the conference I thought of at the musical break. Some of you I know have home businesses or important correspondence to do when you're doing anything in life. We also have full wireless access to the internet at the facilities. So you'll still be able to do, keep up with business, etc. Just, of course, don't interrupt the classrooms. Cell phones are a big no-no in the classrooms. You can do that on your breaks or early morning or dinner or something outside from everybody else. But laptops, if you need to keep up with email or a home business or something, you'll have full internet access, so that will not be an issue whatsoever. So I encourage you to attend. It's going to be a great deal, and you'll meet some friends and share research that you can't do anywhere else. And these friends will end up being lifelong friends. There's still people that correspond all the time from the first conference in 1993. So with that said, I'm going to start tonight's broadcast with a press release that accompanied several important reports concerning global warming, greenhouse gases, etc. And it's from a wonderful foundation out in California, staffed with doctorates, just like we use for research in the University of New Mexico and Wyoming and Arizona and California. And a lot of people are getting sick of the rhetoric, getting jammed down people's throats by traitors like Al Gore, full of misinformation and lies. There is tons of scientific evidence counter that does not get the media hype that the greenies get. And that's my little nickname, or the Green Mafia, which generally I'm referring to the Forest Service or one of those when I say Green Mafia. But to give you an idea, I think that this will be quite shocking, this press release. And then I'll go into some of the reports. When a wildfire strikes California, the state's efforts to stop global warming go up in smoke. A study released today of four large California wildfires shows they collectively put an estimated 38 million tons of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere through fire and subsequent decay of dead trees. Together, emissions from fire and decay undo much of the progress California is making to fight global warming. Consider that the estimated 38 million tons of greenhouse gases is the equivalent of emissions from 7 million cars for an entire year of driving. Nearly 10 million tons of harmful greenhouse gases were emitted from the fires themselves, with an estimated 28 million additional tons of carbon dioxide emitted from decay, mostly in the next 50 years. Now, as an aside, ladies and gentlemen, remember this is based on just four wildfires that lasted from 2 days to 7 days to 10 days, equaling 7 million daily driven cars for a year. Why? Because of environmental bans from the Greenies, the new arm of the World Socialist Party, on logging, proper land management, thinning, of course, production and jobs. What a shame it would have been, huh, to have had that lumber into our lumber supply instead of buying imported lumber and have it used, lowering the cost of building a home or a structure or a back porch or whatever you might be building, and actually using it and cutting down on greenhouse gases, because if it's already milled, it can't be burned very easily, can it? Now back to the piece. Quote, reducing the number and severity of wildfires may be the single most important action we can take to lower greenhouse gas emissions and fight global warming, said Dr. Thomas Bondenkin, a professor emeritus of forestry at Texas A&M University and author of America's Ancient Forests, From the Ice Age to the Age of Discovery, published in the year 2000. Dr. Bonnickson, who holds a Ph.D. in forestry from the University of California, Berkeley, has studied California forests for more than 30 years. The study was conducted for the Forest Foundation, a nonprofit organization that promotes education about the state's forest. The study is based on a groundbreaking analytical tool developed for the Forest Foundation that allows scientists to estimate greenhouse gases emitted by wildfire and subsequent forest decay. The tool, called the Forest Carbon and Emissions Model, FCEM for short, analyzes the impact of wildfires on global warming by considering a number of factors, including vegetation density, tree species, mortality caused by a fire, and the removal of dead trees and replanting new trees. The study included extensive analysis of four fires. The Angora Fire, which burned 3,100 acres near South Lake Tahoe in June and July of 07. The Fountain Fire, which destroyed nearly 60,000 acres east of Redding in August 92. The Star Fire, which burned more than 16,000 acres in September 01 in the Tahoe and El Dorado National Forest. And the Moonlight Fire, which burned more than 65,000 acres in September 07 in and around the Plumas National Forest in the northern Sierra Nevada. Even today, quote, California as a state is committed to reducing greenhouse gases, Dr. Bonnickson said, but these fires demonstrate that much of the effort is wasted when wildfires spew huge amounts of harmful gas in the air and then continue emitting gases for decades as trees decay. Even today, fires that ended months and years ago are still releasing carbon dioxide into the atmosphere as dead trees left in the forest continue to decay. While everyone sees and smells the harmful wildfires caused to the environment, the damage is needlessly made worse by our failure to remove dead trees and replant new forest, Dr. Bonnickson said. Removing fire-killed trees does two important things to fight global warming. It reduces the amount of harmful gases released after a fire by reducing wood available for decay, and it stores the carbon that would have been lost in long-lasting wood products. Dr. Bonnickson added that removing dead trees and replanting to restore the forest can reverse the impact of wildfires on global warming by recovering most, if not all, the carbon dioxide lost to the atmosphere from fire and decay. In addition, he said, it would also help protect surrounding forests and communities from a second wildfire or reburn, which often occurs in unrestored forests that become brush fields filled with dead trees. Unfortunately, Dr. Bonnickson noted, the federal government doesn't move quickly to remove fire-killed trees and replant. For the Angora and Moonlight fires of 07, no removal of dead trees has occurred on federally owned lands, and there is no plan to replant those areas. In contrast, private forest landowners swiftly remove dead trees, turning them into wood products used by consumers rather than allowing them to decay and sink carbon dioxide into the air, and then they replant a new forest. Quote, these wood products continue to store carbon, and a young, replanted, and well-managed forest absorb carbon at a fast rate, Dr. Bonnickson said, and he added, quote, if we care about our forests and fighting global warming, then we must reduce the threat of wildfire and remove dead trees and replant if a wildfire occurs. Now, ladies and gentlemen, I have several reports in full-color PDF style, so I can attach them and email them to you, as well as this press release, which also has a link to videos, etc., that you can watch for free on the real science that goes behind this. Now, these reports and these analytical models are so advanced that even the best land management agencies and scientific agencies around the world are using them. But you're not hearing about that on the news, are you? And finding that these reports are 100% substantiated. See, many of you may recall my broadcasting during the largest fire in history, our Rodeo Chediskai fire, right here in northeastern Arizona. We still broadcast. We were ready to evacuate. An hour of the time, staff and volunteers not only did the broadcast and kept you up to date, but as it pushed 600,000 acres of pristine forest lost, now it's just dead land. The volunteers also worked around the clock around the communities. We were all living on 2 to 4 hours of sleep a night for 3 to 4 weeks, volunteering to cook meals for people that were evacuated to Eager, where we're headquartered. Direct traffic. I went and visited personally every day several elderly people who were able to get out in time with camping materials and make sure they knew where to shop and had water, medical care, etc. If they had some kind of medication, didn't know where to go. Now, what caused that was horrid management. The simple fact is that historically, forests in the Western United States were in the range of about 90 trees per acre, and due to injunctions from environmental socialists, it's pushed 1,000 trees per acre all over the Western United States. Now, that does several things. It makes a fire that becomes so hot you can't stop it or fight it. And when you have the superheated fires, it sterilizes the ground. Nature's natural act of clearing fires through lightning strikes, or even indigenous peoples for hundreds of years throughout history and around the world, using small controlled burns to keep forest and lands healthy, to keep farming and agriculture going, and game numbers high, so they had food and water tables high and flowing cleanly. All that's been ignored because of usurpation of our court system by socialists. So that 600,000 acres that burned into nothingness and superheated the ground, and hardly anything can grow there now. There are no trees growing there in almost any of that area, except for worthless scrub that will never be a useful wood product. And the emissions it caused, and the lack of jobs that were lost because there was no truck drivers hauling lumber out, there was nobody staying in motels while it was getting logged. And remember, the logging goes into several industries, not just boards, paper pulp, wood pellets, glues, solvents, cleaning agents, industrial chemicals, coatings, colorings, dyes, paper, on and on and on. So all those industries, the trickle down of paying higher prices due to less harvesting, then just to burn it all up and send out emissions. Now they're doing model reports for us right now, us being us, concerning the Rodeo Chediskai fires. And if those small fires equaled 7 million daily driven cars for a year, and I gave you the acreage on them, can you imagine what a 600,000 acre fire is going to turn out? And then afterwards, as cited in the reports, the scientific data proving that replanted trees absorb CO2, but trees don't do that forever. At a certain point, they get so old, they actually start emitting it even though they're alive. Had they been harvested, that wouldn't have happened. The young trees absorb more anyway as they're growing than the older trees. And you have a continuous crop. You don't have these super fires. There's economy. There's labor. There's jobs. There's finished products. There's manufacturing. On and on and on. And is often the case, as soon as a fire is done, then the same environmental socialists still will not admit they were wrong. And they go get injunctions against clearing out the dead. And then you can't replant either. It becomes locked down land. Much of the Rodeo Chediskai, as in the majority of what was left still standing and charred, could have been sent to OSB plants. And there was a major corporation that wanted to move here, oriented strand board. That's that, the larger chunked particle board, for those of you who aren't in the know, that you see used on roof sheeting and for flooring of homes, marine uses. Wanted to move in because of the massive supply that would have been here and create hundreds of jobs and a railhead. Now your train companies are getting paid and your trucking companies hauling in raw material, glues, solvents, machinery, welders, and your full-time maintenance people, all that lost because then the injunction stopped any harvesting of the dead. Finally, after 3 years of fighting, people were allowed to go in and it was absolutely useless. It could not be used for heating or power generation anymore. It decayed so much all along, putting out CO2 gases. There was a lot of damaged property and injuries due to blowdowns, and that's just simply the charred tree got weaker and weaker and weaker and blew down in natural winds, damaging fences and homes, injuring people. And when it finally did get cut out, most of it was absolutely useless. It was simply cut and left to lay on the forest floor, where it still is today, and this happens all across the country. And, by the way, no replanting done. Ladies and gentlemen, the reason I'm broadcasting this is because this is one of the major things when people say, or socialists say, more like it, man is causing greenhouse emissions to go through the roof. Man is causing global warming. And they blame it on everything from cows in large dairy farms to vehicles, when actually the majority of it, based on science, is because, that's right, man's fault, but a small cartel that are an arm of the world socialist movement called environmentalist. And don't ever confuse an environmentalist with a conservationist. I am a conservationist. There's a big difference. And many of you are conservationists. But environmentalist, an arm of world socialism, the only fact in all their spewing that they do in court and on TV, and Al Gore runs around in his 20 jets while hyping up carbon credits, which is just another power grab, ladies and gentlemen. Another form of socialist class warfare is what it is. Bar none, 100% fact. The only fact they routinely state is that humans are the cause, and yes, they are. Through their injunctions and their lawsuits and their use of funds from like the World Wildlife Foundation, the World Wildlife Fund, and through illegal treaties like GATT and NAFTA and the Rio de Janeiro summits, when they influence policy as humans, they are the cause, not the average Joe riding a motorcycle to work and back, or using a can of spray paint once or twice a year to pretty up his garden chairs. So humans are the cause, yes, but not in the ways the media is telling you. It's through their court actions and job destruction, which is part of the plan, ladies and gentlemen, to cripple our economy. The higher the jobless rate, the more industries that are gone, the higher products cost because there's less people and less people supplying that job and also making a paycheck and spending money elsewhere, the higher prices. All this leads to that artificial tax called inflation and devaluation of the American dollar. And it trickles into other industries. This ties in heavily, both artificial taxes called inflation, the devaluation of the value of our dollar, the American dollar, that is, and land policies that we have are the biggest effect on the skyrocketing fuel prices right now. The government is the major cause. Not some dwindling supply. In fact, it was announced just 2 weeks ago by the major oil producers at a European summit that they're sitting on the highest reserves they've had in 12 years. But all the trickle-down policies and court actions and government mainly policies are driving the price up, ladies and gentlemen, not the oil companies. The profit on a gallon of fuel is only a small portion, and percentage-wise is much smaller than all the costs incurred because of government policies. The government is the single largest price hike in the price per gallon of fuel. Not the producer, not the distributor, not the little mini mart selling it. The government, its taxes and policies. Actually causing it to double. Can you imagine right now if you got rid of all the illegal taxes and the court-ordered mandates that are that compliance then drives up price of the producer, how low gas would be again? And then can you imagine all that extra money? Economic theories have already proven, and I say theories and proven, that sounds like an oxymoron, but they are economic theories when you're in that field of economics. But they've proven a thing about marginal propensity to consume. And basically all that says is if you save someone some money on some item or some price, whether it be an expendable or a hard asset, like a piece of real estate, they're not going to run and put it in a savings account or put it in a coffee can. Almost always, they're going to spend that extra money they saved anywhere somewhere else. So can you imagine gasoline back in the dollar and some change area and energy not based on fossil fuels because we would use naturally occurring wildfire fuel for energy production, a renewable source that we can control and manage, that absorbs CO2, doesn't emit it. Can you imagine how much more disposable income Americans alone would have, let alone people around the world, to spend on going out to dinner, which employs people, renting a video even. Employs people. Someone has to be standing in the video store to rent you that. Someone has to ship those videos to the store to have them on the shelf. People have to clean carpets at night, wash windows, on and on and on. Now I'm going to go into some of the scientific data, and if you email me, OurTheTime@Hotmail.com. I'll attach 4 stunning reports, 2 scientific models, which will just blow your mind to read. This web release, I call it. It was a press release, but it was released on the internet before the regular media because they knew it wouldn't get covered, and sure as hell it didn't. And then a book called The Saving the Forest Book. It's a PDF book. It's a wonderful document. Full color, you get images, maps, scientific data, charts, and the other 2 reports I mentioned, FCEM, Forest Carbon Emissions Model, are simply all the core scientific data and boring black and white print to back up this colorful PDF book. But I'll send all 4 to you, no problem. As an attachment, simply email me, OurTheTime@Hotmail.com. And I imagine Rob, because he always a few times I've offered this, and lo and behold, it ends up on the website, and someone can just click there. He'll probably do that as well, because he thinks like that. I don't. And always catches all my loose ends for me. But I'm going to go into this report, and some of the interesting research has gone into it through documentation using old photographs. And remember, there's photos, all of you know that, during the Civil War. So we've got a lot of data to gather from. And a smart guy can say, well, this is in such and such plateau, or such and such plain, or such and such wagon drive, or such and such governor's inauguration. And in the background, we know for a fact that this is that background today, and it's this much acreage, and we can count the trees. So there's hard data, plus the indigenous peoples from North America and around the world in their own writings, to prove how God put the resources there. They can be managed. They are renewable. It's absolutely amazing, ladies and gentlemen. But real quick first, I'm already out of water. I need to get another drink. And so I'm going to run to the sink during this short musical break here. Gentlemen, again, you're listening to the Hour of the Time here with your host, Doyle Shamley, in Eager, Arizona. And big thanks to all of you who tune in to the Hour of the Time. And we appreciate your support through donations. We are listener-supported, ladies and gentlemen. And I think a lot of people forget to and don't realize that maybe in the first hand, but a lot of people forget. You'll notice you're not hearing a bunch of overpriced coins being advertised and miracle cures in a bottle. Instead, we teach you to do it yourself here on the Hour of the Time. But also, we don't have corporate sponsorship paying for the airtime, which is actually better, though, in the long run. Now, I'm going to go to, in that PDF book, for instance, one of the given chapters. There's several chapters, full color. And with this PDF document, you can use this in your own area if you want to educate people. There is a lot of public facilities that we use routinely, but I find people don't take advantage of them. We'll call someone at a local library in a meeting room or a city facility like a city hall, and they'll have digital projectors and microphones and speakers, and they'd love to have the community use them, and they're not used. Boardrooms, hotels even have boardrooms. And you can organize a meeting. Drag your CPU down there. If you have a laptop, all the easier. Borrow one, whatever. Show this PDF up on the wall, screen by screen. It's not a PowerPoint, but big deal. It's still page by page, real easy to go through. And educate people in your area on real science. Take it to a church meeting. Or have church members come to your house or meet you at one of these public facilities. You'd be amazed at all the speaking engagements that we do, how inexpensive the facilities are for the people hosting it. Oftentimes donated. And if there is a cost, it's generally just because they want to cover the lighting being on in that room and the toilets flushing in the restrooms and the drinking fountains and a staff person to hang out till you're done so they can lock it up. Most of these accommodations are available in evenings, so you can't use that excuse. Public libraries, city and county facilities, universities, companies, a lot of companies, even small companies, have a boardroom. And if you just go down and talk to them, maybe you do business with them, it's your insurance provider. They'll oftentimes have a meeting room right in their State Farm office, for instance. So think about these resources and start getting your communities educated. Use them. In one of these chapters here, just to give you a highlight of how neat this PDF book is, besides all the photos and charts, historical and modern, and animations to explain things, is the wonderful text, clearly written and easy to understand. This particular chapter, a portion of it, is forest health and wildfire. Historically, low-intensity fires were common in California. Most fires burned often and gently, with low flames creeping through grass and pine needles while licking benignly at the base of large trees. Where brush had grown dense or patches of older trees were unusually thick, flames would flare up, leaving in their wake small openings where young trees could flourish. These low-level fires were the norm for thousands of years. About half the fires were ignited by lightning strikes and the rest by native peoples who used fire to improve hunting conditions, create safer living areas, thin oaks to increase acorn crops and other purposes. They kept California's forests open with a mosaic of patches of trees of different sizes and ages on the landscape. Large, catastrophic fires were rare and forests teemed with wildlife. However, that has changed. Starting in the early 1900s, people began putting out forest fires and altered the natural fire regime. Without low-intensity fires to keep them open, forests began to grow more crowded. Many forests we see today are not natural, but far denser versions of their historic predecessors. And ladies and gentlemen, one thing that isn't tied in directly here yet, but they get to it, is land policy. Remember the founding of the Forest Service and several other socialist land agencies in 1905 and 1906. And remember the movement, which we've detailed here extensively on the Hour of the Time, and their agenda. They started on it immediately, ladies and gentlemen. Now to continue on with this chapter. Forests that just 150 years ago were described as being open enough to gallop a horse through without hitting a tree are now so dense you can barely walk through them. In California's mixed conifer and ponderosa pine forest, 500 or more trees per acre often now stand where less than 70 trees per acre stood historically. Today, forests in the Lake Tahoe Basin are four times denser than they were in the 1850s, and most government-owned or government-controlled forests, I had to add that. We are teaching them, though, about the legal terms, and they're already updating their reports, ladies and gentlemen. In the Sierra Nevada, for instance, are about 10 times denser than natural. 10 times denser, ladies and gentlemen. Instead of 70 trees, 700 trees per acre. Forest density has increased by more than 70% in Southern California's San Bernardino Mountains in the last 60 years alone. This overcrowding has horrific implications on forest health and wildlife behavior. It also can have devastating effects on wildlife. The plants and animals that need sunny openings are disappearing. When grasses and shrubs get crowded out, the wildlife that needs that habitat for food or cover is lost. Streams are drying up as thickets of trees use all the water. Insect infestations and tree mortality are reaching epic proportions. Now to digress from the piece, ladies and gentlemen, that is absolutely true, and I can show you vast swaths of what were beautiful forests less than 10 years ago are now gray matchsticks waiting to burn, whole hillsides and ranges due to beetle infestations as they become overcrowded due to socialist litigation and management policies. They become weaker. You see large, vast gains become endangered. I can show you where elk will try to evade you when you're out sightseeing and looking at them and taking pictures or driving towards them, and they can't even run into the forest for cover because their horns hit the trees. I'm not exaggerating. I've shown some of you in the audience, in fact, much of these areas already. And the water table all across this country, as this is happening and happening, is drying up. Not only is it drying up due to the massive amount of water being absorbed by the excess trees, but indigenous grasses that grew there for thousands of years are disappearing. And like the report said, those bugs and small animals that use that for cover and food disappear, and it works its way right on up the food chain. Remember, ladies and gentlemen, the major factors doing this started in the early 1900s. And that began with the establishment of the illegal federal agencies, illegal based on statutory authority, common law, jurisdiction, and delegation of authority around this country. Fish and Wildlife Services, U.S. Department of Agriculture, Department of the Interior, Forest Service, and on and on and on. Now I'm going to get into the bark beetle and some from this report, even though I've kind of highlighted what they've done to vast swaths of land around this country. And I was seeing this when I was in the military in California and Oregon in the early 90s. Huge swaths of land. Gray. I didn't know what caused it. I thought, what in the heck? Because I grew up in thick forest and redwoods. And I started getting these other areas, and I started seeing it happen back home. But I educated myself and found out what the cause was. It wasn't exhaust from vehicles driving by, ladies and gentlemen. Bark beetles have thrived with the onset of unnaturally dense forest. Bark beetle outbreaks in California and much of the West have increased roughly 30-fold, 30-fold, ladies and gentlemen, between, and get this, 1998 and 2004. We're not talking about hundreds and hundreds of years of history, ladies and gentlemen. And in 04, for instance, was a year that went down where more than 1.7 million acres of national forest lands in California experienced insect infestations. 1.7 million acres. Between 2001 and 2004, millions of trees were killed in Southern California alone, and experts predict more than 21 million additional acres of western forest will suffer significant tree mortality from bark beetle attacks during the next 15 years. Bark beetles have already killed up to 33% of the trees in some parts of the Lake Tahoe Basin. Nearly half of the pine trees are dead in the San Bernardino and San Jacinto Mountains. The same is true on Southern California's Palomar Mountain. And many of California's state-owned and public lands simply have more trees than the land can sustain, which is causing forest health to suffer. Humans have put out the fires and restricted the timber harvesting that could have thinned these forests. Since 1990 alone, harvesting on California's public forest lands has dropped nearly 90%. In healthy forests, trees can fight the bark beetle attacks. They encase the attacking insects and sap and keep them out. But in overcrowded forests, trees compete for water, food, and sunlight. Without enough nutrients to go around, trees become stressed and susceptible to insect attacks. And with forests unnaturally dense, trees have barely enough moisture to produce the sap needed to keep out bark beetles even in relatively wet years. They cannot resist attack at all during dry years. A healthy forest can survive a beetle attack during a drought with only moderate mortality. A thick and stressed forest cannot. Drought may have triggered some recent insect epidemics, but it didn't cause them. The real cause is overcrowding. Too many trees is also the reason that catastrophic fires have become more common in recent years. With an abundance of dead, dry trees in the forest, fires burn hotter than natural. They can easily jump 8-lane highways and blow right through or around fuel breaks. Intensely hot fires create strong winds and can hurl firebrands or bits of burning trees up to a mile away. There is nothing natural about a 200-foot wall of flames racing across the landscape. California's historic forests were more open, fuels didn't accumulate, and fire stayed mostly on the ground. Now, as an aside, ladies and gentlemen, I had family members that worked on trying to fight the Rodeo Chediskai fire. Not as Forest Circus employees, of course, but as private people who knew how to stop it. And of course, most of their advice was not heeded by the government bureaucracy. And this is documented fact that when these several firemen are killed every year, why is that? The winds that the fire creates will get that fire going harder and harder, and you get into super fires and topping fires. And it will leap across tops of trees, crown fires they're called, and they will burn so hot that trees 60 and 70 feet away will explode as if they had dynamite in them. It is a truly scary sight to see, ladies and gentlemen. When trees explode, they get so hot that the gases and saps in them expand so fast that they're not even on flames yet, and they explode. Loss of life, property, jobs, nature, due to poor management. And the only facet the environmentalists are correct in saying that humans caused it. But not the way they're telling you, ladies and gentlemen. This is how humans caused it. Now, wildland urban interface is something I have to deal with extensively in our fights for land rights around this country, state by state. WUI, as it's often called. Let me explain a little bit of that. Obviously, humans have long been a part of forests around this world. But between humans and overgrown forest land, it's created extraordinary dangers. According to the California Department of Forestry and Fire Protection, their branch of Fire and Resource Assessment Program, about 8 million people now live in wildland urban interface and are at significant fire risk. Now that means communities like ours that are right in forest areas or right close to them. Now remember, when you have fires leaping hundreds of feet, blowing up trees because the heat produced, making 80-mile-an-hour winds that no one can outrun a fire traveling that fast, it gets into cities really quick. Now, in the next 15 years, California alone will add another 6 million people to that wildland urban interface areas. Living amongst the trees without caring for and thinning the forest is proven to be lethal. In the decades preceding the Southern California firestorm of 2003, forest management came to a virtual halt in the San Bernardino Mountains and elsewhere. As early as 1994, forestry and fire ecology experts identified the dangers the overcrowded forests in Southern California posed and proposed actions to reduce the fuel loads. Their recommendations went unheeded, their proposals left on the shelf. In 2003, Southern California wildfires claimed 24 lives, destroyed some 3,700 homes in a predictable and preventable catastrophic event. Southern California is still not safe. Millions of dead trees covered the mountains around Lake Arrowhead, Big Bear, and Idlewild. Thousands of acres stand in tinderbox conditions. Furthermore, conditions similar to those in Southern California's forest before they succumbed to beetles and flames in 2003 are appearing increasingly throughout the Sierra Nevada and Lake Tahoe Basin. All told, more than 2 million California acres burned between 2000 and 2006. 8 million acres remain at high risk of catastrophic wildfire. And the main reason is that humans have altered the natural fire regime and severely restricted forest management that can mimic natural effects to thin forest. Leaving forest alone doesn't work. Southern California's 2003 firestorm makes clear what professional foresters have known for years. Forests need management to be safe, healthy, and productive. Today, California's historically patchy forests are gone, and in their place stand unnatural, dangerously thick forests that spread across the landscape as one continuous blanket of fuel. We have the science, expertise, and technology to restore them to their naturally healthy condition if we want to. With restoration forestry, we also have a viable plan for doing so and protecting our future. That's right, ladies and gentlemen. Historical and scientific data shows where greenhouse gases are coming from. And yes, it is caused by humans, but by socialists and their policies. Not by the exhaust out of some motorcycle on a weekend ride, or from your vehicle getting to and from work. The most devastating impacts come from our lack of ability to understand real land management. Ladies and gentlemen, I want to thank you for tuning in this wonderful June evening, 2008. Your host here, Doyle Shamley, with the Hour of the Time. And be sure to tune in every night to the Hour of the Time on our website, hourofthetime.com. And thanks, Monty, for broadcasting us there on Radio Free Vermont. And I hope everyone has a safe and a studious evening.